Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Our top story today continues to be the social distancing Michigan's leaders have ordered to slow down the spread of the new coronavirus. The pandemic has some very serious consequences for multiple sectors of Michigan's economy. We're going to explore some of them this hour. Later on, we'll hear about what the United Way is finding out on its 211 phone line about the areas of greatest need.
It's all hands on deck. It really is. And that's the only way it works when you have this level of crisis happening.
But first, several factors are presenting challenges to Michigan's employers right now. I mean, first off, there's the legal restrictions on hours of operation. Customers of many kinds are also staying in and feeling reticent, if not downright spooked, about what the next few weeks may bring. Brian Calley is president of the Small Business Association of Michigan. He joins us today by Skype. Brian, welcome back. You represent a variety of businesses. What landscape of conditions are you hearing about right now?
Well, it's across the board. Of course, everybody is extraordinarily worried and concerned, but the impacts are different depending on what type of business. As we saw, the governor's executive order closing down a lot of types of businesses. That, of course, those types of businesses are really profoundly impacted. They literally have to close down. And while it was kind of overall billed as bars and restaurants, it's really much, much wider than that. So for small business owners, they're usually not in a situation where they have big cash reserves on hand and they can just close down for a while and get started back up. And unfortunately, particularly with bars and restaurants, once they close, a lot of them are never going to be able to open back up.
We know that this is big trouble for the service industry and a number of different kinds of retailers, but what other kinds of small businesses might be affected that might not be as obvious walking around in commercial strips?
It is really across the board. So most businesses serve other small businesses, and so it creates kind of a ripple impact. So naturally, we have a concern for supply chain interruptions and small manufacturers that are part of very large supply chains, global supply chains. That's kind of one category. But then in that case, it might be more of a cash flow problem as opposed to a catastrophic business event. Take for example a CPA who's preparing taxes for a small business, or otherwise doing financials, and we have a widespread closure of businesses. That's going to affect the business services industry as well. I would imagine that there's a lot less marketing and communications that businesses aren't out there promoting products right now because of the nature. Even if they weren't shut down, it's just not the right environment for it. And so, right, you can imagine just right across the board, a lot of businesses that aren't affected by the closure orders are still profoundly affected by the overall situation. And so we know that it's that the overall economic impact is going to be bad, maybe like what we haven't seen for a very long time, including the Great Recession that
right.
happened the later part of the first decade of the century. I mean, that's the level we're talking about is probably worse than that. And that's so we're really gearing more toward, of course, information and compliance, but also survival. How do we now think about the overall survival of the economic infrastructure of how people make a living and get jobs in this state? Because when we come out of the other end, it's not like everything's just going to open right back up. The resources will be very depleted at that point.
So as you communicate the governor's orders to your membership, of course, there's the closure of restaurants and bars, but also the banning of, you know, many kinds of gatherings. Are there certain types of questions that are lingering for you about how these will be carried out?
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of gray areas in where businesses operate, and they don't fit into these neat categories. So, just take for example, if apparently it's okay still to do haircuts and hairstyling to the extent people are still going out for that. Obviously, that business will be depressed, but the but it's not okay for a lot of spa services. Well, some companies do both. You know, there are other cases where you know, bars and restaurants can still do carry out and pick up, depending on which what license you have. What about alcohol? Some people have a license to serve alcohol carry out. Other people don't. And even if the ones I think most probably turning out, most of them do, but it's only for beer and wine. At, you know, but a lot of these organizations, it's the margin, how what they survive on are mixed drinks. And so,
yeah. Or I'm guessing something like a brew pub that has a full service dining room, you know, that a significant portion of the money they make comes from sales of alcohol.
It does. Now, thankfully, the license, most of them would probably have a license that would allow them still to serve beer as long as it's in a container that is unopened. But you can imagine how, like, there's a lot of catches. Like, they can technically still operate under some conditions, under some modified practices or limited services. So you can't do everything you did before. You can do some things, and some are just completely shut down. So that's where we're trying to really sift through, especially those that make public accommodation. I mean, there's kind of broad language about, you know, take for example, golf clubs was included in the closure order. But it took some time to get to the answer. Okay, so the clubhouse has to close, and mm-hmm. if they're serving restaurant, you know, food and beverage there, what about carts that are out on the golf course, and what about the golf courses themselves? It turns out the golf course, of course, can still be open, but you know, those are the sorts of things, and who's going to be out? But that's just, even though they can technically be open, who's going to be out playing golf? And so. That's why this impact really, as we really start to follow it through to the end, we can see that the closures are one part of it, but the economic impact is so broad that we're going to have to think on a different scale than what we have before.
What kind of event horizon is the association suggesting that people prepare for? This, no one knows, but this is starting to feel like a bit more than a 3-week proposition.
It is. It's in fact, the president suggested it might be much longer than that yesterday. So I think we do have to think, start thinking long term. And I actually do have some ideas that I'm investigating right now that I think are innovative and can at least give us a chance at survival. So I'm not ready to unveil that. Maybe if you're interested, we can, once I vet through them, I can call you first. But there's there's a few immediate things that need to happen, and those immediate things are like we have some like sales tax remittances due on Friday, and quarterly tax payments that are due soon. Like just the idea of waiver of penalty and interest for late payments. Like let's just say. Anybody who fails to pay their taxes in the next few weeks, we're not going to do tax liens on them. We're not going to do levies on their property and that sort of thing. We're going to extend that out for a couple months and just give a little bit of breathing time. That'll cause some cash flow problems with government, but as a practical matter, those sorts of things, we need to think about short-term triage and what's realistic and possible. And then the other thing is we need for government not to just assume that businesses can be the social safety net. That a lot of these businesses they're literally at a point where they have to shut down. They can't be the social safety net for society. That's a responsibility the government is going to have to pick up. And that's why I was very pleased to see that at least for those businesses that are forced to close down, that and their employees will make unemployment claims, that won't be counted against those businesses and their unemployment rates should they be able to reopen later on.
Brian, I know that you've expressed concerns about many different kinds of businesses, but are there businesses or workers you think are most vulnerable right now?
Well, the ones that are most vulnerable are the ones that are literally forced to close down. So those are the ones where cash flow goes to zero or close to zero. Those are the ones where the employees are facing immediate layoffs and the businesses are It's just for many of them, it will be a catastrophic event. There's not a way to convert the business into a different form so that it can keep on operating. So I would say those are the biggest immediate concern. However, all of the rest of them, including really big companies, so the entire economy, every day that this goes on, so if we're talking about 3 weeks now, if it goes beyond 3 weeks and it's, you know, if it's 2 months, then we're talking about a whole different level. So hopefully we aren't faced with that. But if we are, I think that a lot of the economic components that are considered to be strong and maybe the strongest, well, they'll definitely be tested.
Brian Calley is president of the Small Business Association of Michigan. Brian, thanks so much for taking some time with us.
Thanks so much for your attention to this and everything you're doing.
While some businesses will find ways to stay open and afloat through this societal shutdown, we saw a note on social media about one in particular in Detroit that's already making the hardest decision a business has to make. Rachel Lutz owns the Peacock Room as well as several other clothiers in the city, and she wrote this: "Today, I'm doing the most heartbreaking thing I've ever done, laying off my entire staff, temporarily shutting down my stores." She went on to say she's depuffing her eyes, showering, and putting on clean clothes. She will mobilize and organize relief from a safe distance and donate blood. We're sending some well wishes from stateside to Rachel and all the small business owners figuring out the way forward all across Michigan. Coming up, starting a cannabis business in the era of social distancing. One co-founder says she's sticking it out as a commitment to customers.
I stay in it for them. I also stay in it for the opportunity to build real wealth for our families and generations to come.
That's next here on Stateside. You're listening to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Michigan's retail entrepreneurs are weathering strange days. We like to say that important businesses are often founded during a downturn, but the level of uncertainty now facing startups is not run-of-the-mill. At the same time, cannabis entrepreneurs are profoundly aware of this moment as the state's legalized markets are beginning to come online. This may be especially true in African American communities, disproportionately hit by generations of drug laws and a historic disparity in access to capital. We've invited the leadership team of one of these startups to join us. Collexium is a company now forming to provide cannabis, including edibles, dry herbs, and concentrates. Latoya Rucker is Collexium's president and founder, and Rebecca Collette is the CEO. Ladies, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you
for having us.
May I just begin by saying that everyone has a business plan, but relatively few emerging businesses have a disaster plan right out of the gate. How are you two doing?
I think we're doing okay. I think cannabis is one of those things that has stood the test of time.
I mean, as much as people have been joking on social media about practicing social distancing with one of Michigan's newly legalized products, it does seem like there might at least be an opportunity here of some sort. But I'm sure you guys have concerns for both customers and staff and just how the whole economic picture looks for the next couple of months.
Yeah, it's definitely something we're concerned about just because people are afraid of touching people, and we're going out talking to investors, going to networking events. So there's definitely some precautions there. And honestly, I am, you know, a little afraid of what's going to happen next. You know, how long is this going to last? How long are events going to get canceled?
Yeah, it's a different kind of relationship building when you cannot even shake hands with a potential investor. Well, let's talk about this process of building the business, though. Latoya, I know your background is in education.
Yeah.
Can you tell us about what you were doing before you founded Collexium?
Yeah, so I opened a daycare center in East Point, Michigan back in 2012. So I've been in education since then. I achieved my master's degree in early childhood while I was running the business. But cannabis has always been something that has been a part of my mission and my purpose. Kind of being a caregiver in Michigan, kind of during the Wild Wild West days, while also running a childcare facility was kind of what I've been up to.
Indeed. Was there something that you saw with your caregiving experience that made you start to think seriously about getting into this as a business?
Well, it was a personal story. My grandmother, she suffered from a lot of chronic pain, and cannabis really helped her. And I just wanted us to be able to do it the legal way. And so I went and got a card and became her caregiver and became a caregiver for myself as well. So I was able to grow 24 plants legally.
I don't want to invade medical privacy by any means, but would you be comfortable talking about how it's helped you?
Well, definitely. As far as being an athlete, I've played basketball all my life, and cannabis has helped me with all the different pains that I've had, shoulder pain, knee pain. So it's just really been a medicine for me.
How did you two get together on this project?
So four different people recommended that we should meet. I think it was just our overall spirits kind of aligned in the mission that we had as far as, you know, having a passion for cannabis. Rebecca, she has a personal story with veterans. And so maybe she can kind of share a little bit more about that.
Yeah, when a bunch of people start saying, you know who you should talk to, that's always a big green flag.
Yeah.
Rebecca, tell us a little bit about how this became a possibility for you.
Yeah, I really became passionate about cannabis after my dad unfortunately passed away. He was a veteran and was addicted to opioids. So after that tragedy happened, I really started researching medical cannabis and the lack of access that especially veterans have to a legal product. Even if they live in a legal state, a lot of times they don't have access to this because if they get drug tested, they may lose their VA benefits if they find, you know, a Schedule I drug as cannabis in their system. So I just became very passionate about being advocates for people who wanted to use plant medicine, who I think should have that choice on whether they take, you know, a plant, a tincture, or Vicodin. I think they should have that choice. So I just became passionate about being an advocate, and on my advocate journey, I've met some pretty influential politicians and entrepreneurs in the cannabis space. And me wanting to move back home to Detroit, everybody kept recommending LaToya and you guys should work with each other. And I think, you know, your missions are the same. And we met and have easily found kindred spirit within her about our mission, our vision, and our passion really to bring this plant into the community, into the city of Detroit, and really help people from a health and wellness standpoint. That's what we're really passionate about.
Rebecca, I'm so sorry about your father.
Oh, thank you.
Did he ever speak openly about, you know, this conundrum of, you know, a lack of legal options for something as truly fundamental as pain medication?
Oh, my, yes. You know, he has been in pain ever since I've known him. Ever since I was a child, he's been in some type of pain. And, you know, the recommendation from the VA was keep coming back and we'll keep giving you more pills. And what I realized for that, it really wasn't a cure. It was more of a temporary pain relief. And I was very passionate about finding something for him and other elderly people I knew that was more of a cure, something that could offer more than temporary relief. Just being very involved in a lot of veteran nonprofits, the stories that I've gotten are the same, that there's no access to plant medicine and that these opioids that they get prescribed, sometimes the side effects are worse than the pain.
LaToya, will you tell me, what did it take to obtain a property to get the business started?
A lot of blood, sweat, and tears. So when the city of Detroit kind of released the zoning map, I kind of started trying to find a building, a location that was within the green zone. So it took me about 2 years looking at properties. There's a few real estate companies that exist. And so I kind of went through them and then also did searches on loop.net. And so once I was able to identify where those properties were, you know, I started kind of contacting those companies, kind of building relationships. And, you know, people knew who I was in the industry a little bit. So they knew that I was serious in what I was trying to do, and just developed a relationship with a building owner where I actually purchased a building out on the west side of Detroit. He just saw the vision and he believed in me. He got approached by several other people, but he believed in what we were trying to do. And we kind of moved forward with the business deal and purchased the real estate.
What's been your experience getting the capital that's needed to get the business off the ground?
Oh, wow. That's a great question. with cannabis still being a Schedule I drug federally, it makes it very difficult to go after traditional financing that may be available if you're trying to open up a restaurant, per se. You know, a lot of loans aren't available. A lot of grants aren't available because to the federal government, this is still a drug. So for us to be a small business owners, we can't go up to Bank of America and get a loan, you know, for this. So it's been really difficult. Approaching investors individually also has been very difficult because they're skeptical of this market. They're skeptical that the regulations seem to change often. They're skeptical that it's still regulated on the federal level. They're just skeptical about investing. Honestly, you know, to build out a project such as ours, we're raising close to $2 million. In the network of us both growing up in the inner city of Detroit, we really just don't have access to those type of people who can write those type of checks. That's been also very challenging, is being able to get in those rooms with those people who have those type of capital resources.
If you're just joining us, my guests are Rebecca Collette and Latoya Rucker. They are the CEO and president and founder of Collexium, a cannabis business getting off the ground in Detroit. I'm sure you both were listening with full attention to Mayor Mike Duggan's State of the City speech when he said he wants to ensure equity for Detroiters when it comes to licenses to sell cannabis. Of the 40 medical dispensaries operating legally in the city right now, only 4 are owned by Detroiters, so that gives us just a sense of what the recreational market may be up against. What comes to mind when you think about bringing that idea to reality? I mean, access to capital, for sure. If he were to ask, what would you say the city should do to try to make this more than just a point in a speech?
Well, I think they should start a fund specifically, you know, for social equity candidates and for people that have been living in the city. And I think Rebecca can also talk about Illinois and what they're doing. They have a really great program.
Rebecca, what have you seen in terms of models in other states for social equity in cannabis?
Yeah, you know, what I've seen is often in these states, they have the same challenges. You know, they'll offer a percentage off of application fees. But really, where the real hindrance is for a social equity applicant is that access to that capital for that build out. And what I've seen in many other states on the West Coast is they have these programs, but they still don't have access to capital. However, Illinois has an impressive social equity program where they have both state funding. So they have a state fund, and they also have access to low interest grants, low interest loans. They also have some of those bigger cannabis corporations that have pretty large market shares. They have local funds, too, to support social equity applicants in the Chicago and Illinois market. So it's really kind of putting their money where their mouth is. That's something that Illinois has done really great with. And since that's kind of like our neighbor, I would hope that Detroit and the state of Michigan would take heed to what they're doing and how it's helping Chicagoans and social equity applicants really start their business. You know, we can have a business plan and everything on paper, but what is it going to take for us to be operational? And that's capital, real capital.
Rebecca, have you become aware of anything in the private sector by which investors might be taking an equity focus? I mean, is anybody making that money available right now?
You know, I've seen a couple of bigger corporations. One is Cresco Labs. They have a fund where they're trying to fund local, smaller cannabis businesses. A couple other companies I've heard of, a Michigan local company, Pleasant Trees, they have plans to build also a social equity fund in the Michigan area. So there are plans to do these things. However, I don't think too much of it until I see the money. So I always say, show me the money.
Right.
You know?
And I guess
all these words are cute, but I need to see the check.
And I guess saying funding local businesses does not necessarily mean funding Black businesses.
Exactly. What is the criteria?
Right.
And are you going into these communities really finding these people? Because, you know, if you're not in the community, how do these communities even know these opportunities are available? So it's also lining up that communication. So you letting the community know that these opportunities are available so they can apply. That's something else I've seen in the cannabis industry, you know, across the country, is people often don't know these events are happening. They often don't know these licenses are available. You know, they often don't know that a free workshop was held to, you know, talk about filling out your application. It's also that access to information is an issue.
There has been so much interest in some of the Western states that legalized earlier among big corporations, and not a small amount of concern about how the entry into legal recreational market was going to play out in many communities. And it's perhaps not a surprise that big companies with a lot of money have become big players very quickly. What are your thoughts on how, on what you need to make sure that as larger players continue to move into the Michigan market and into Detroit, that you have a chance to compete?
I think it's just about our approach, you know, and our approach is that we're female owned, we're minority owned, we're pushing a brand that really focuses on the patient and more of a boutique style of cultivating. And so I feel like, you know, just like you have with big alcohol, you have your big players in the game, but then you have your smaller breweries, craft breweries. And I think cannabis, the landscape will be very similar in Michigan.
I mean, people do want to buy from people they know in terms of distilleries, in terms of food products. Can we assume that that would be a thing for cannabis as well?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. And that's what we're pushing for with Collexium, that you know where we are. We're located in Detroit, and we really do put the patients first.
What does the name mean?
Collexium? Yeah, so my background is also in biology. You know, I love science and the anatomy of the cannabis plant. There's a part called the calyx, and that's where the medicine is produced. And so it's just a play off of calyx, Collexium.
Given that you both came into this thinking about consumers who, you know, maybe might not have had access to the kind of medical benefits that cannabis has to offer, how did you design the product line with them in mind?
For me, just listening to my patients over the years, like I said, I've been doing this and been in the industry since 2009. So I've traveled all over the world and really been able to obtain genetics from places like Spain, places like Jamaica, and just with the patients in mind, listening to what it is they actually want, what they need, their pain, their ailments, their strains out there that exist that specifically are tailored for those things.
There are so many other kinds of business that you two could have gotten into that wouldn't be facing the kind of regulatory challenges that you're dealing with right now. Can I ask each of you to just say what's kept you going during this process? The years of trying to find an appropriate building, the years of trying to make the relationships with investors that would give you a real shot at this. Do you want to start out, Rebecca?
Certainly. I mean, there are a myriad of reasons. First is the personal impact that the plant has had on my life and my family's life. I personally am a patient as well. It's helped me a lot with anxiety and things that have happened in my family. It's helped me tremendously. It's helped people that I've known. So really thinking about, like, to LaToya's point, patients first, you know, I think about the patients that I've helped, that she's helped, that we've helped together, and their stories. I stay in it for them. I also stay in it for the opportunity to build real wealth for our families and generations to come. This is a multi-billion dollar market, and we're just at the beginning. And I think it's a great opportunity for small business owners such as ourselves, women of color from the inner city of Detroit, to have opportunity at building wealth for generations. Also for our community. With that wealth, we have plenty of opportunities and avenues to help our community. We want to start a nonprofit, to build playgrounds, to have after school programs, to educate the community about plant medicine. We want to offer employment opportunities to Detroiters. We really want to create workforce development. We want to train these people who are interested in jobs in the cannabis industry. We want to train them. We want to make them equipped so they can apply for these jobs in this multi-billion dollar industry. You know, with Detroit and Michigan hitting so hard with a lot of industries leaving, you know, such as the car and the automobile industry, you know, we see cannabis as an industry that could really revitalize Detroit, that could really make Detroit a big poppin' city again, like it used to be, you know, with Motown and Ford Motor Company. So we really see cannabis really improving our city, our community, the health, and it's kind of been our driving factor. And one of my favorite quotes is, if it doesn't challenge you, it won't change you. So this has certainly been a challenge.
Rebecca Collette is the CEO of Calixium. We've also been talking with LaToya Rucker, the president and founder of the company. Ladies, good luck with all of this, and we really appreciate your time today.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
The United Way for Southeastern Michigan is running point on collecting and disseminating money for organizations helping those in need during the societal shutdown. That's next on Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. What a time to be working in social services. Every single child in Michigan home from school, older Michiganders isolated for their own safety, and a raft of people who have needs ranging from nutritious food to medical care and much more. The United Way is staffing helplines and raising money in a coordinated campaign for COVID response. And we're joined now by Darian Hudson, PhD. She's president and CEO of the United Way for Southeastern Michigan. Darian, welcome to Stateside.
Oh, thank you for having me, April.
Where is your immediate attention today?
Today, we're really focused on our COVID-19 Community Response Fund. We've currently raised $3.5 million. We're working with the philanthropic community to put dollars out to target food distribution for our children and our elder, our senior population, and really focused on our shelters that are currently overwhelmed by the population as well as concern for the spread of the virus.
I take it that your prioritization right now is informed by what's been coming in over the United Way's 211 helpline. Is that your detector right now of the most urgent needs?
Yes, between 211, our call center, as well as requests for support that we're getting on our website, we actually have a COVID-19 response landing page that people can go to at www.unitedwaysem.org/COVID. And that's where we're also getting quite a few requests. And I'll also say, just talking with our partners, the philanthropic as well as our nonprofit agencies, we're all on the same page in terms of what the slate of needs are. And now it's just activating.
What have you been hearing the most about on the phone lines?
The concerns continue to be around utilities. Remember that 44% of the households in our region are unable to meet their most basic needs. So even before the pandemic started, we were still, our highest volume of calls is always around utilities, around housing, around food. And so that has not changed. What we are seeing now are a lot of calls around testing, where to get tested, what do they do if they have any of the symptoms that we've been discussing. And so we've worked very closely with the health departments to make sure that everything that we're telling them is aligned with the CDC guidelines, making sure that people are getting the help that they need.
And this is the case even though many of Michigan's utilities have said that they're suspending shutoffs for the foreseeable future?
Now that is the case, and this has happened over the past, you would say, a couple days here. But when this first started, we were still definitely hearing the needs about utilities, housing, and food, access to having food. And so, again, the food issue is not only for children. It is also for our senior populations as well. And so we're working with a number of the food pantries, food distribution centers, to make sure that we can get food to them now that a lot of these locations are closed.
You mentioned just a little bit earlier, the United Way is involved in some specific fundraising for COVID-19 response. When did it become clear to you that there was a need to organize philanthropic efforts on a large scale around the coronavirus crisis? Was there a specific moment when it was obvious this was not going to be your average flu pandemic?
Certainly. Once the governor declared a state of emergency, and I would say even the day leading up to that announcement, there were just a number of signs and indications that we needed to be prepared to respond. We had to have all hands on deck to serve our community. And so many different conversations have been happening, April, through Zoom meetings, Teams, through phone calls and texts. And it made sense for us to just step up and bring people together and try to coordinate resources and efforts.
Is there anything difficult about getting up to capacity and time to put that money to work?
There is. We're working across county organizations, the cities, and then working with nonprofits and the philanthropic and community. And there isn't one single platform where we can have all of this information. It is truly happening by word of mouth, by phone calls. And so the amount of time that it takes to make sure that everyone has the same information and then to act on it is actually very complex. R2-in-1 is connected to 1,300 agencies, and we currently fund about 70 organizations directly. And now multiply that times, 30 organizations that do the same thing, you can imagine how complex it is. So communication has really been key. Transparency and sharing information and flexibility, just being nimble, no matter what time of day, no matter if it's a weekend, we have to be available to talk, to work through details, and to get these resources to the community.
Are there corporations that stepped up right away?
Yes. The Skillman Foundation was first, followed very quickly by DTE, the Quicken Loans, and the Gilbert Family Foundation soon followed. And we also have support from the Community Foundation of Southeastern Michigan and Blue Cross Blue Shield of Michigan. And I really want to say these conversations happened on Friday afternoon of last week, all through the weekend and yesterday. And we're actually still waiting on a handful of funders to call with their contributions. So it's all hands on deck right now, truly.
Darian, you used to be the superintendent of public schools in Milwaukee, and you have an academic background in education. I imagine that you're thinking a lot about school districts and families right now. What are your primary concerns for kids who are tucked away and out of school for the next couple of weeks?
The top concern really is access to food. So many of our children, that's how they eat every day, is getting a breakfast, a healthy breakfast and lunch. And so I applaud all of the superintendents and the school districts that are still remaining open with their grab-and-go stations to make sure that young people are still eating. But I do think about their parents. So many of their parents are not working because of closures and downsizing and in the midst of this pandemic. And so that's always a concern. Also, their academic learning. I'm so proud of our families and our educators for the innovation that's taken place during this time. People have schedules to follow at home. They have materials that are being disseminated from Detroit, Pontiac, Southfield. A number of our districts have found ways to either give students devices or give them the academic learning materials. But this really is a challenging time, and it takes everyone being flexible and nimble to realize we've got to stay focused on making sure that the children and their families have what they need. The last shout I just wanted to give was to our bus companies. Most of the bus companies in the school districts are helping to deliver food to the medically fragile students, to students with special needs. So it's all hands on deck. It really is. And that's the only way it works when you have this level of crisis happening.
It's not as if Michigan doesn't have experience with weather-related stoppages for schools and businesses. But this is really kind of different in, I guess we'd say, the duration. How would you rate our institution's readiness to fill the void? I'm thinking about social workers, wellness checks on families that may be living in extreme poverty or where there've been problems of neglect and abuse.
Mm-hmm. Because of the level of I would say, crisis at this point, with the fact that most of our nonprofits and social agencies are closed to the public, that they're having to work offsite, has made a lot of our usual systems and sort of go-to strategies very limited. So I would say, in terms of our ability to really execute right now, we have a lot of work to do. I give a number, but it's definitely on a scale of 1 to 10. It's below 5. It's probably below 3, mm-hmm. if I'm being honest. It's not a judgment, because we haven't seen anything like this. Like you said, we've had weather. We've had, social unrest and things of that nature. But usually you can still bring people together in the same space, and you can lock yourselves in a room and figure it out. And this is so different, because we have to rely on technology. We have to rely on what we're doing right now, these conversations, and trying to systematize all of these conversations. So it's very complex. And again, I applaud everyone for getting out of our comfort zones and putting our heads together to figure this out. And I would also say, you brought up the duration. Just timing and how long we're expecting this to happen. The fact that we are limited a little bit, because now we're having to run our organizations by telephone and by computer. It's we're learning as we go. And I would say to anyone who's listening, we must document every moment of reflection and lesson that we're learning along the way, so that we can not only make sure, because we can't say this won't happen again, but we the next time we'll be much better prepared. We'll have those kinds of emergency systems in place, cross-institution, that will really help us.
How are you getting yourself through day to day?
So I am definitely a woman of faith. I believe in meditation, definitely prayer. I have an awesome team of mission-driven folks who are going above and beyond to make this work. We've been working every day, sun up to sundown, including weekends, and I'm not alone. I would say the other piece is there are just as many CEOs, employees, staff members who are working just as hard. And I'm also inspired by the fact that so many people are trying to help. They're trying to figure this out. So whether you're on Facebook, seeing your friends, sharing, preschool lessons with each other, or volunteers, we've heard from Teach for America and Flagstar Bank and Boys and Girls Club, who are saying, hey, things are different for us right now. We have volunteers who want to help. That's how I get through my day. I would definitely say faith, having a really strong team at United Way, and then partners who continue to step up to the challenge, and who are just as inspired and motivated to serve the community as I am.
Darian Hudson is president and CEO of the United Way for Southeastern Michigan. Ms. Hudson, thank you for your time.
Thank you so much.
We would be weeping into our green beers today if only it were possible to go out and do such things. This St. Patrick's Day is definitely going to be one to remember, if only for the lack of public festivity, with Michigan's restaurants and bars closed. For many of us, it's not that big a deal to defer celebrations to slow the spread of the new coronavirus, but what if your rent actually relies on the revelry? P.J. Ryder, the owner of P.J.'s Lager House on Michigan Avenue in Corktown, is the site of many, I don't know, Paul, what should we say, spirited St. Patrick's Day gatherings?
Spirited, large, Irish, celebration of spring, whatever you want to call it. It's always been a huge event.
I wanted to ask, P.J. Ryder, how will you be spending the day today?
Well, I'm at the bar presently. I put on my jersey that I normally wear on St. Patrick's Day. And I'm cleaning is all I'm doing. And there's a few little bit of tip money for various people that worked the last couple days. Called them up, said, come on by and pick it up if you'd like. I'm just kind of trying to catch my breath and figure out, where and how things are going to happen in the next, well, I'd like to think 2 weeks, but I really got to be thinking 2 months. And I'm worried. I'm very worried. I don't know what the government might do. I don't know what my insurance company might do. So far, my bank or the IRS of the state of Michigan or the credit card companies or the insurance company, none of those said, don't worry about paying us for the next couple of months. We got you covered. No one said that to me yet. So
right.
I'm trying to figure out how I'm going to pay my bills. We have a payday a week from Friday. It's only going to be 1 week's worth of pay, but I'm thinking about maybe trying to give it to the employees early just so they have a little bit of money right now. You know, it's just hour by hour, moment by moment, and that's where we're sitting right now, trying to figure out what the rules are. And to-go business is not a natural business for us in any way, shape, or form. It'd be difficult to do and difficult to maintain the volume needed to keep a couple employees. So last night, I had to admit, I was sitting here after we kind of had wound down. Weirdest feel in the world. Got the bar all ready to go for St. Patrick's Day, and there ain't going to be a St. Patrick's Day. So.
Paul, how many customers would you normally see for a St. Patrick's Day crowd?
Oh, it'd be hard to say, but we have four large days a year. St. Patrick's Day, Opening Day, Parade Day, and Santarchy are four biggest days of the year. One was constricted, one was eliminated, one's been pushed back till May, if that, and the other one happens in December, so hopefully we won't have a problem with that come around December. I talked to someone who used to own a bar in the street, and he said, literally, this would have killed me, and I said, why is that? And he goes, because what I do, 10 months of my bills get paid from Parade Day and St. Patrick's Day. Those 2 days pay 10 months of my bills. Everything else, I just try to keep it going.
So is that how it is for you? I mean, is it analogous to Black Friday in retail?
Yeah. It's analogous to Black Friday in retail. It's analogous to the art fair in Ann Arbor. Every city seems to have some event that draws a lot of people and pulls them into the particular neighborhood. Well, we have all these events downtown in Hart Plaza and Campus Martius and stuff like that. It doesn't really pull stuff out to Corktown. Traditionally, the only things have been the Parade Day and St. Patrick's Day. So overall, all the way around, I'm missing my Black Friday. I'm missing my art fair. I'm missing, you know, the thing that draws people here for at least one day a year where you know you're going to have an overwhelming number of people. I would say if an average crowd, you know, this is on the low side, with an average crowd of 30,000 people come down to Corktown on Parade Day normally, I would say if we had 1,500 this year, that was the most. There was no more than 1,500 people here total all day long, all Corktown. Where there was nobody on the street, it was not crowded. And today would be the same thing. Today, St. Patrick's Day usually starts out. You know, there's a few revelers that come out early in the day, and then they just kind of stay steady all day, all night. So yeah. Today we'll have nothing. So,
Paul, do you have a lease on the building?
I own the building.
Well, that's one thing. I mean, do you still need to make mortgage payments, though?
Yeah, I got two loans. They're personal loans out on the building. I don't think either one of them will foreclose on me. But the IRS, I worry about a lot. The state of Michigan, I worry about a lot. The credit card companies, they're still going to want to get paid. The insurance companies are going to want to get paid. And just, I got no income to pay them. I have some cash right now, but a good portion of that I'm going to call my accountant and say, write out those paychecks now so I know exactly how much I need. Let's get them out to the employees and then see what's left and pay what bills we can and write everybody else a note that when I can start paying again, I will. I hate to seem like a terrible radical, but it sure seems to me that whenever things go to hell, the big boys get saved, the banks, the car companies, the people have billions and billions of dollars. And the guys who get stepped on are the small businesses and the small business employees. And my employees are going to be hurt big time. My employees started a GoFundMe to try to raise some money for the Loggerhouse crew just to see if they can get some of our regular customers to donate something to them just to help them through. But then again, every bar in the neighborhood is doing the same thing. It's just a very, very bizarre situation. You know, Michigan Avenue looks like it did 13 years ago before Slo's opened, before I opened. And when this place was a dark, nothing going on strip of Michigan Avenue, that's what we're at right now.
Paul Ryder is the owner of PJ's Logger House. It's on Michigan Avenue in Corktown. Paul, we're really sorry you're dealing with all this, and good luck to you.
Yes, I'm not the only one. We're all in it together. Hopefully we'll all come out the other end all together and we'll be fine for the most part. So tell everybody, wash your hands, take care. And when your local establishments reopen, please patronize them.
Well said. We hope we see you on the flip side.
Okay. Thank you very much, April. Appreciate it.
That's our show for today. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm April Baer. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you tomorrow.